Hey, this is Adam Richman from Food Network UK, and you are feasting your ears on the Hotspur Podcast. Come on, you Spurs.
Welcome to a brand new Hotspurs podcast. It is Wednesday, the 27th of May, 2020. I am Steve, and on today's My Spurs journey, we have got Mr. Pete Haynes. How are you doing, Peter?
I'm doing very well, Steve. Thank you.
Excellent. Now, again, you are somebody that I haven't met. Very rarely interact through Twitter, if at all. I do know of you because you've been on the Spurs show many times. And also, you are Martin Clone's boss, Martin Cloak's boss, aren't you?
That's not quite right. Martin's, my role on Tottenham Hotspur Supporters Trust, I'm the secretary. So Martin Cloak and Cat Law co-chairs, and we work together on trying to get a good deal for the fans. So that's part of my background. Been doing that job for about almost 4 years now.
Okay, so you got good cop, bad cop, and then you're somewhere in the middle. Is that right? I don't know.
Yeah, it's a strange role. It's I say strange. You're basically a company secretary because that's the setup of the organisation.
Yeah,
we're controlled by the Financial Conduct Authority. We are a company, and we have to do things by the rules. So that's really my job as secretary, to ensure that we adhere to all the rules, all of our processes and our policies, and that we do things properly as we should.
Brilliant. And I mean, we've got straight into it there, obviously, with that, and it's straight in with the heavy stuff. obviously, we do My Spurs Journey questions in just a second. Do you go to the meetings with Levy, with I think Kat and Martin go? Do you go as well?
Yes, I do. Been going to those on a regular basis. We meet 2-3 times a year with the board. So we do Donna, Simon, and depending who's around, normally the head of ticketing, head of safety, head of security, and we discuss all things related to the fan interest. Yeah. So we don't get involved in on-the-field matters, although, you know, we will ask some questions about, for example, what have you learnt from 5 years of Pochettino, for example, that cropped up at the last meeting we had. So at the moment, we're tied up in dialogue with how you're going to refund people for the 5 games that are still outstanding on our season tickets this year.
Yeah.
And people who have already purchased tickets through Ticket Exchange, how does that operate? How does that work?
Yeah.
Also, we're getting increasing dialogue with premium ticket holders, premium season ticket holders, who have already paid for next season.
Yes.
And have been offered a credit on the 5 games for last season. And they're saying, well, I've got a 3-year contract that ends at the end of the 21 season.
Yeah.
What's a use is a credit to me? So there's a whole host of dialogue going on with that at the moment. I mean, it's a very difficult position for the club and every football club to find themselves in. You know, there's no revenue coming in,
yeah,
apart from the odd sale through the shop. And they've obviously got operating costs to continue. You know, the players' salaries, I don't think, as far as the latest I've heard, still hasn't been resolved. So I'm not quite sure where they are with that.
Yeah. Now, if you refer to Twitter, of course, Joe Lewis should be paying for all this. he should just be doing all this. It's nothing to do with anything else. He's just out of his own pocket and whatever else. He should pay for it all. And you should be storming into those meetings, demanding that we buy the best striker available. I just think it actually, when you mentioned, you're going into these meetings. And it just reminded me the other day I heard Darren Bent asking Noel Gallagher if Oasis are going to get back together after the coronavirus thing. And Noel Gallagher said, Christ, did you lot draw lots on who was going to ask me that question? Because obviously that. So when you three go into the meeting, do you sort of say, who's going to ask him if we're going to buy a striker?
To be fair, we don't ask that question. We've got specific areas that we look after. I mean, my area, apart from being secretary and taking notes and minutes of those meetings, is also very much angled into community and the charities that we support. We have two charities that we raise funds for. One is a local charity called Studio 306 Collective, who basically help people with mental health issues who are also artistic have an outlet for their craft.
Oh, fantastic.
Based in Enfield, absolutely brilliant charity, do a great deal of good work. And we also support Prostate Cancer UK by having a team enter their cycle to Amsterdam every year to raise funds. I think we've raised over £100,000 since we've been doing that for about 7-8 years, I think.
Yeah. Now you say Amsterdam, all the Fighting Cock listeners have all, their ears have pricked up there.
Yeah.
Got your attention.
I know, you know, it seems so fresh in the memory, you know, just over a year ago now, that we got back from Amsterdam and we're absolutely buzzing and we're in that absolutely incredible period leading up to the final where we were.
We'll come on to that in a minute, Pete. as you were saying, you do a bike ride, so you're fighting fit.
Me, I don't do the bike ride. No, I'm ancient. My body is a complete and utter wreck. I played football for not a very good standard for up until I was about 25. I had problems with cartilage. Then took up hockey, played hockey up until I was about 50.
Yeah,
brilliant. Whereas now I just do a bit of walking and try and keep as healthy as possible.
I had a few mates that used to play down at for Trojans down at Southampton.
Right, okay.
Don't know if you ever played them. But Sean Curley was the great hockey player, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. I can remember sort of watching the, was it 96, no, 80, 88, wasn't it, in Seoul, I think,
yes.
When they won the gold medal.
Yeah.
I was actually in Sydney watching hockey for the Olympics in 2000 and followed the England team
for... And for all our American and Canadian listeners, this is proper hockey we're talking
about.
On grass. Not the ice figure skating thing that you guys do. No, I'm only joking. anyway, mate, let's get into the questions then, and we'll touch on a few other bits as we go along.
Sure.
So, brilliant. So, who is your favourite football club?
Oh, it's got to be Tottenham Hotspur. Nobody else.
Why is that?
It's really through my father. My earliest memory of football was watching the Cup Final, because it was one of the very few games that was ever broadcast live on TV.
Yeah.
I can remember being quite taken by Tottenham winning the FA Cup in 1961, which gives you a clue as to how old I am.
Okay.
And having watched that game, and then the following year when Jimmy Greaves was purchased, in the playground, I was Jimmy Greaves. I was the goal scorer. And modelled myself on Jimmy Greaves. My dad,
where's the playground, Pete?
Playground in Stevenage. My family moved out of London in 1960 to Stevenage Newtown, where I lived on and off ever since. A few trips around the country, but other than that, mainly in Hertfordshire. Yeah. So my dad, as I say, he was a football fan, and he said he was a Tottenham fan. But he worked Saturdays, and living in Stevenage, they didn't go regularly to football at all that I can remember. But there was a crowd of the blokes where he worked who started going midweek to the European Cup and European Cup Winners' Cup games in the early 60s.
Yeah.
So he used to come back with the programmes, tell me stories about how brilliant it was. I can remember him telling me about the night they played Gornick, which all of the ex-players like Cliffy Jones, you know, talk about the atmosphere, the noise, really intimidated the team. So he'd come back with all his stories, he'd come back with a programme, and I'd read them, and it was, that really got me hooked. Never, it took me a while to actually get to my art lane for the first time, so that would have been in 69, and then, you know, whilst my mum and dad were umming and ahhing about whether they'd let this their little boy go up to Big Bad London on his own. I used to watch the local team. So my first memories of watching football, live football, were at Stevenage.
Yeah.
When they were in the Southern League, so Division One and also in the Premier. And an ex-Spurs player was playing at the time, a guy called Johnny Brooks, whose son, Sean, played for Crystal Palace, amongst others. So there was that link there. So I used to go quite regularly to Stevenage, probably from about 63, probably up until about 69. And my first visit to White Hart Lane, there was a crowd of us at school, at senior school, who played rugby. All football fans, most of them were Tottenham fans, and what we used to do after playing rugby in the morning on a Saturday would be jump on a train up to London and go and watch Tottenham one week, Arsenal the next week. As a lot of people did in those days.
A lot of people say that. Did they support Tottenham and Arsenal, or was it like you'd support Tottenham and you just go and watch the Arsenal game, or was it literally you go and support Tottenham and then you go and support the away team that's playing Arsenal? How did that work?
Well, speaking for myself, I know that it was I'd support anybody who was playing Arsenal because I was vehemently Tottenham at that
time.
Other people I've heard and have met since who had season tickets at both grounds, you know, and they just enjoyed football and supported both sides, but probably would have an allegiance one way or the other. So I think in those days there was so little outlet for leisure time that football was so highly attended, and people would just go and watch football because they love football.
Yeah,
obviously,
I think that's fantastic. Is it a case then, just on that, the fact that if you said to a Spurs fan now or an Arsenal fan, listen, here's a free season ticket to Arsenal, go and watch them week in, week out. I doubt I would go to more than I'd go to the Spurs game, obviously. I might go to two or three others, but you know, literally, you couldn't pay me to go and watch Arsenal strap up there. Is that because everything was closer? It was closer. I mean, travelled, or was it the fact that the rivalry wasn't as fierce?
I don't think the rivalry was as fierce. I think I became more aware of it the more that I started watching Tottenham, especially when they played Arsenal in the derbies. Probably the first derby I saw would have been about 1970. The one game that I didn't saw, one of the many games that I didn't see and got locked out of in those days, because it wasn't all ticket, you just rocked up on the day, was that infamous night when Arsenal won the league at White Hart Lane in 1971. I, along with probably about 150,000 other people, were trying to get into that game, and I'd never seen White Hart Lane so crowded. We got there about half past four. I think we left straight after school, so we would have been in Tottenham about half four, quarter five, and we couldn't get in. It was that crowded. Gates were locked so early. And I remember standing on the corner during the game, along with thousands of other people, standing by the corner pin on the corner of White Hart Lane.
Yeah.
And trying to work out from the crowd sounds what was going on, because although it was on, I think it was on the radio, and people have said since that they were listening to it on portable radios, I don't remember anybody near me in the crowd having a radio, and we were just going on the reaction of the crowd. And when the noise went up with a lot, you know, late goal that scored, it sounded like Tottenham had scored. But of course, there were so many Arsenal in there that in White Lane that night, it was the other way around.
Yeah. And you're saying that at that time, it wasn't as hateful, would you say? Or
I think it was around about that time that I began to realise that there was that, not just the history, but also the fact that, you know, people really disliked each other. I'm sure your listeners will know of how it was the Woolwich Wanderers, as we all like to jokingly call them, when they were based in South London in Plumstead. And moved into North London, into a new stadium by some fair means and probably some foul means. I think some palms were greased. And they obviously invaded our patch, and that rivalry has obviously been there. But I think over the years since I started going, it's become more intense. As you were saying, if someone offered me a free ticket to Arsenal, would I go? Well, maybe if some of my Arsenal supporting mates were going and I went as a group, I'd probably have the day out. But if it was just sort of come along and watch us play, it would be, why would I want to do that?
Yeah. Have you got a pair of salmon chinos and that you can wear up to Arsenal?
No, I definitely haven't.
You've got to fit in. If you don't wear your salmon chinos, they'll know. Right, okay. What's your favourite country?
Australia. Mates, we've got about three sets of friends and some relatives as well. We all live out there. It probably tells you something that some very close friends have moved as far away from us as possible. But we've been there six times.
Whereabouts in Australia?
I've got relatives in Melbourne. I've got friends who live just outside of Brisbane, and friends also live in a little place called Albury, which is on the border in New South Wales. One of the friends, it's a very long story, but the woman who got myself and my wife together emigrated. We lost track years and years ago.
Yeah.
And through a quirk of events, her sister met another set of friends who'd moved out to Australia one night. The common theme was we were all based in Stevenage. And they were talking around a table or something. They were thinking about moving the family out there, and our names cropped up, and suddenly it was like, oh, you must know my sister. And we were then back in contact with a girl who got myself and Jill, my wife, together.
Yeah.
38 years ago now.
Yeah.
We'd lost touch completely, so it was absolutely brilliant to get back in touch with them and meet them again after all these years.
Fantastic. So let me take you back then. So you're on the dance floor. You see a girl, you go and say, do you fancy a dance? She said no, but my mate will. And that turned out to be...
wasn't quite that. It was Grand National Day, 1982. And I'd backed the winner. And my brother said, my brother, who incidentally is an Arsenal supporter, he said, why don't you come out for a drink? You know, we spent some of your winnings, we'll have a drink. Went to a local pub. And there were friends of friends there. Jill was in there as well. We started talking, and the rest, as they say, is history.
Yeah, fantastic. Right, mate. On to question number three. We better move on because we're 20 minutes in. And honestly, mate, I could talk to you all day because the Spurs, these last two or three, I mean, all the shows I've been doing recently have been fantastic. But I had Terry Hill on yesterday, massive Spurs fan. Rob White on Monday, who was just terrific. And hopefully I've got one or two more who are just live and breathe Tottenham. And I could just do this all day. It's great chatting about it. What about, let's bring it down then. Let's bring the mood down slightly with who is the player that you dislike the most?
John Terry.
Okay,
absolutely, yeah. No doubt. Just disliked everything that Chelsea team stood for, their arrogance, nastiness. Just hate's a very strong word. Dislike intensely, I think.
Yeah. I mean, putting all the, you know, all the other stuff aside, the stuff off the pitch and everything else, and the Rio Ferdinand, Anton Ferdinand situation. And I was talking the other day about the England team and the fact that, you know, with England, we had these players for the golden generation, if you like, for 10 years. John Terry being one of the players who, you know, he's playing in European Cup finals. He won a European Cup final, although he didn't play, but famously put the kit on. You know, and he's won multiple Premier Leagues, best league in the world, playing alongside either Rio Ferdinand or whoever else was around at the time, with all the other great players. But as an England fan, and I'm not just saying this as a Spurs fan, I was ashamed that you're looking at these players, you know, Rooney having his issues, if you remember rightly, or, you know, with his wife pregnant and all that sort of stuff going on. Just a group of horrible, horrible, you know, choices they were making, if you like, if I'm going to be diplomatic about it. And we had to support this group of players. And they were all at the top of their game, all playing brilliantly. Came to England, absolutely load of old rubbish. And I think John Terry epitomises that. Yeah, he should be the leader. He's the leader, the legend, the everything that Chelsea say he is. For England, he was absolute dog crap, wasn't he?
Yeah, you look back and, you know, subsequent, you know, years, I think some of those guys have mellowed, and they, most of them say, you know, we missed such an opportunity with that golden generation. That team should have won something. It should have been so much better. And what quite a few of them, as I recall, have said, the team rivalry that existed at the time, you know, it was really toxic between Chelsea, Man United, Arsenal, and Liverpool were the main protagonists at the time.
Yeah.
And the fact that they disliked each other so intensely on the field during their club battles, some of that rubbed off into the England side. So they didn't really operate as a team. Yeah, one of the benefits that we have now with Southgate is the team ethos, and that works very, very well. So a team of not necessarily superstars are able to achieve, you know, the semi-final of a World Cup.
But I think that also stems from Kane being captain.
Yeah, oh, definitely.
You, you know, so you go back to that era. Was John Terry the captain? Probably for a few of those games, maybe.
I think it might have been for a while, yeah.
Or it might have been Gerrard or whoever. But John Terry certainly should have been one of the guys going, right, you lot, we have got a chance to win a European Championship, a World Cup. Let's bring it together. But no, he decides to go into that England team and just divide them. I mean, I'm with you. I am absolutely with you in my dislike for him. What about the football team, the actual football team that you want to beat the most, you dislike the most? Who is that?
I always want to beat Arsenal. Yeah, my brother is, as I mentioned, is an Arsenal fan. So there's always banter going on about that. I clearly dislike Chelsea. I dislike West Ham only because they always, not always, but tend to raise their game against us. And then are absolute rubbish for the rest of the season.
Yeah.
but it is Arsenal. Intense rivalry. I always want to beat Arsenal. It's nice and, you know, sort of with the rivalry with Chelsea, you know, they tend to be more of, you know, sort of punching partners over the past sort of 5-6 years when we had the success under Pochettino. But yeah, it's still Arsenal. Maybe I'm a little bit old school because I know a lot of younger people are saying, you know, that rivalry is much more intense there with Chelsea.
Yeah. Well, I quite like that in a way, because what we're saying is we don't really bother about Arsenal anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
We're so superior to them. We're not really bothered.
That's right, yeah. We had 20 years of them looking down the nose at us, and now, you know, the boot's on the other foot, and we can take the mickey out of them.
Let's rise it up again, because that all got a little bit miserable then, and I got a little bit depressed talking about John Terry. So let's improve it a little bit by talking about your favourite ever Spurs player.
So many to choose from. Two that I really can't choose between. I've had the joy of meeting both of them. Firstly, Jimmy Greaves. You know, I mentioned earlier that he was my hero in the playground. Yeah. He was emulated. He scored the goal in the very first Spurs game I ever saw. I saw his last goal for Tottenham. I saw his last game for Tottenham. I saw him play against us when he was at West Ham, and have met him on a couple of occasions since.
And just describe, Pete, what he was like as a player, because there's so little footage. Everyone's seen the Man United goal where he dribbled down the team and scored. But there is so little footage of Jimmy Greaves. Some have said he's, you know, watch Messi, that's what he was like. Well, how would you describe him, if you can compare him to a modern-day player? What was he like?
Well, I think Messi's instinct on the ball and his dribbling skill is the same as Jimmy's. His sense around... Greavesy was more of a box player. Although he did score some goals from outside the box. He was more of a box player. He had an instinctive understanding of where the ball was going to be, where he needed to be. And he was clinical in front of goal.
A bit like a Lineker in that respect.
Yeah. It's probably unlike any real modern-day player. I suggest probably more like Defoe in that instinct.
Yeah.
Maybe not as much pace as Defoe, but certainly the instinct around the box and in the penalty area to be able to be in the right place at the right time, be agile. Scored a few with his head, but not that many. I mean, he's not a bulking, strapping centre-forward like Martin Chivers, who subsequently took his place, for example.
Legs, though.
Yeah, and he never really had the presence. He never really did a great deal of work in the defensive two-thirds of the pitch, really. You know, the ball would be lost to the opposition. There was no such thing as the press in those days. So he'd stand around on the shoulder of the centre-half waiting to get possession. But as soon as we were in possession and attacking, he'd be moving. He was very good at pulling defenders out of position. He didn't necessarily go out to the wing that much, although he did stretch a little bit. The older he got, he started doing that a little bit more, creating space for others.
Yeah.
But an absolute genius for goal scoring, as his record shows.
Yeah.
And my second one is Steve Perryman. One of the earliest games I ever saw, in fact, it was the first time I ever went to Wembley, was in 67 for a schoolboy international. And a young gentleman called Steve Perryman played that day. And we're of similar ages, basically have grown up together. I watched his first game for Tottenham. And saw him play all the way through, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s. And again, have subsequently met him. Such a nice guy, absolute diamond geezer, who played so many different roles for Tottenham. I was there the night he scored two against AC Milan in the UEFA Cup, and wasn't necessarily renowned for his scoring, but also in the end ended up playing sweeper, right back, midfield, a genuine all-round great guy who knew his limitations and knew what his skills were and what his strengths were and played to those strengths and was a consistent performer. You know, you very, very rarely ever saw Steve play a bad game. He would always be, you know, Mr. Reliable.
Brilliant. So are you going with him then for your favourite ever player?
I go with Steve, yeah.
All right. What about your favourite ever manager?
I was old enough to see the Bill Nix side in the 70s, so the success that he had, having regenerated a team probably for the third time, was incredible. You know, sort of the first sort of 5 years of me watching Tottenham, it was FA Cup or League Cup success, UEFA Cup success. And I grew to become accustomed to the fact that Tottenham always won trophies. So from that point of view, you know, and then subsequently understand a lot about the history that went before that, when he played for Tottenham and when he also managed Tottenham from 1958 and the success that he had with the double side, he would always be my favourite manager. Pochettino, I have to say, is the one that really grabbed my heart and turned our team into almost world beaters. You know, that 5.5 years with Pochettino is something, you know, I'll treasure forever. But I would say my favourite is, because of the history of the club, Bill Nicholson.
And what about a legendary player? Doesn't have to be a Spurs player, but if I said to you a legendary player, who would you immediately think of?
I think, again, going back to the early days when I first started watching Tottenham, you know, I haven't already mentioned Steve. I would have said Steve in the same context. But, you know, guys like Terry Naylor, John Pratt, who weren't the greatest ever footballers you would see, but they always gave 100% for the shirt.
Yeah.
They are legends in my eyes. You know, guys like Phil Bill as well, very unsung. Probably unlucky that he played around the same time as Bobby Moore.
Yeah.
And to my eyes, although I saw Phil play more than Bobby Moore, he, to me, was as good. He read the game as well as Bobby Moore. Maybe he wasn't so much of a leader because there were so many other strong characters in that side in the early 70s. To me, you know, those guys are the legends that, you know, again, I look to and think about. You know, there are some, you know, world-class superstars. You know, you talk about Bale and Van der Vaart and Modric and players like that, but I always go back, or tend to fall back on, those early days in the 70s when I first started watching the club, where they made such a big impact on me.
Can I pin you down to one legendary player?
I'd say John Pratt.
Okay, brilliant. What about, we'll rattle through these.
Yeah.
What about your favourite goalie?
Pat Jennings, by a mile. Always remember a game, saw him play up at Leeds in the FA Cup. We lost 2-1. We should have probably lost about 10-0 that day, and Jennings was absolutely phenomenal. He must have made 8, 9, 10 brilliant, world-class saves. And such a nice guy as well.
Your favourite defender?
For 1 year, Richard Gough. If he'd have played longer, I'd have said, you know, he would have been a legend and he would have been a real superstar, but he only stayed with us for a year.
Do you know, in the same vein as him, and he never gets mentioned, but yeah. I thought Nabet for that one season was also just fantastic for us.
Yeah, he was, yeah. I'd say Ledley King.
Yeah.
Again, having met him subsequently, such a lovely guy. And with all of the injury problems that he had to put up with, the way that he did end up performing for 90 minutes, absolutely phenomenal, absolutely incredible. You know, the power that he had and the timing and the strength that he had. So, yeah, I'd say Ledley.
I just wonder if Ledley's a lovely guy and he's softly spoken, which is possibly why he hasn't got that coaching role. But I wonder if he obviously that's what we've seen in interviews and everything. I wonder if he should really be on the bench next to Mourinho. You know, one of the, you know, they have about 3 or 4 assistants these days, don't they?
Yeah,
I wonder if he should be there. And at half time, you know, Mourinho says, Ledley, go and have a word with the lads, you know.
Yeah, I think he's become more involved with some of the youngsters at the club. I vaguely remember him being asked that question about coaching, and I think he's now becoming more attuned to taking his badges if he's not already started.
Yeah.
I think he would be ideal because, you know, he can relate to the younger generation. You know, been there, done it all, seen it all.
Yeah. And I think that also that when you mention the younger generation, of course, you know, they possibly don't want someone to be, you know, all, look at me, I've got so much passion. Maybe that sort of laid back, listen, fellas.
Yeah.
Maybe that laid-back one-word answer might work better with the younger generation. I'm not saying that they particularly, you know, are lazy or like, you know, but you know what I'm saying. What about your favourite ever midfielder?
Probably about 2 years ago, I'd have said Christian Eriksen. Now I probably would fall back with the hindsight. To Luka Modric, I think he was a genius. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I am not. He's not in my top 10.
Right.
And we're not going to have a big debate about it because we're getting on so well, Pete. I personally think let's fast forward 20 years. I'm going to say that Eriksen is looked on more fondly than Modric, but possibly not. Let's go to the favourite striker.
Jimmy Greaves, without hesitation, despite everybody who's come since, and obviously how much we all love Harry, I'd still say Jimmy.
I think Jimmy Greaves would probably be... if when you talk about a world 11, best ever world 11, Jimmy Greaves would probably, if not be one of the two strikers, certainly somebody in the top five, and definitely in the top 10. Me and my boy, we were, took the dog for a walk the other day, and he's only 10, and I said, come on, we've talked about just about everything we can possibly talk about football over the last 2 months because there's been nothing else. So we said, come on, we haven't done the best ever world 11. He said, Jimmy Greaves, Dad. And I went, do you know what, you know, if you took a poll of all football fans over the last 50-60 years, Jimmy Greaves would be right up there.
It would, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of it's a generational thing, and it's, as I was saying, you know, the guys that I started watching back in the 70s, you know, they're the ones who stick in my memory probably more fondly than the current crop of players. Although, you know, I can fully see that in 5-10 years' time, if Harry finished his career with us, which I think is probably unlikely, but if he did, was a one-person club like Ledley, you know, he'd be a legend and he'd be my instant choice, you know, as the best ever centre-forward Tottenham have had.
Yeah. We've already kind of covered this, but the first football match you remember seeing?
Live, it would have been Stevenage, whoever they played. I mean, one of the games that I do remember watching was a testimonial game for, and this really dates me, for Stanley Matthews. So I'm old enough to say that I've seen Stanley Matthews play. But Stevenage played Port Vale in a friendly, and it must have been like a farewell tour for Stanley Matthews.
It was 50, wasn't he?
He must have been, 1967 it was. So that's, I can remember Stevenage playing Merthyr Tydfil on Easter, over the Easter weekend on a sandpit of a pitch. It was a boring 0-0 draw. I can remember us winning 6 or 7-0 against a couple of...
Let's take you to that match, right? So you're at home. Mum says to you, okay, Peter, off you go to the football with your dad.
No, as I said, he was never really that interested. You know, I went on my own and then got to know people at Broadway.
Right. You go to Stevenage versus Merthyr Tydfil, and the point I'm going to get to is you watch a 0-0 on a crappy old pitch. You get back home, walk through the door. Your mum says, oh, hello, tea's ready. How was the game? And you go, 0-0. And your mum goes, oh, that's a shame. And you go, Nah, it's brilliant. I'm going back next week.
A great day, isn't it? Yeah. It's that way. How do you explain the joy of going to watch a football game to people who don't fully understand what it's about? You know, it isn't just about what you're watching on the pitch. Yeah. You know, meeting your mates, chatting with people, the shared experience, all that sort of thing. Yeah.
Half-time, burger or hot dog with onions and
can
of pop when you're that age. big hairy blokes swearing around you.
It's funny, it just provoked that memory because I used to live probably only about a 10-minute walk from Broadland Way in Stevenage. So I'd get home and I'd be able to see, if I ran, the results coming through on a teleprinter on grandstand, and my dad would be there, you know, with the newspaper writing down and checking his pulls.
The pulls, now that's not come up. There used to be the thing, wasn't it, when it was kind of a joke or a sad statement that it was always the saddest day of the year was when you look at the back of the newspaper and the pools was the Aussie Rules matches.
Yeah.
Because you knew that was the end of the season.
Yeah, when you come across names like Geelong and Hawthorne and you're thinking, where the hell are these places, you know, and then subsequently go and actually sort of visit them. But I did the pools when I started work as a civil servant. We had a pools collector in the office and I did pools for, I don't know, 20-odd years. Yeah. Did the same numbers week in, week out. I can probably still remember them now, but I won't bore you with that.
My granddad did the pools. My dad didn't, but my granddad did. Just what's the pools? Tell us very quickly, because football fans, the younger generation won't know.
Basically, you had a list of all of the games in the Football League. So in the old days, Division 1, 2, 3, 4, Scottish Leagues, Division 1, 2, and 3. And the idea of the game was you paid money into a pool and you had to predict 8 draws. Doesn't matter whether they were score draws or no score draws, but you predicted 8 draws and you got, 3 points for a draw, 2 points for an away win, 1 point for a home win. And the idea was that the pool was shared out. So if you got 24 points, i.e. 3 draws, you would get a share, depending upon how many other people had predicted 8 draws that week. So
very British thing, you're predicting draws.
Yes, yeah. People will be making
millions. Listening to this going, you don't get draws in football.
Yeah.
Is
back in the 60s, you know, you could win £1 million, which was a hell of a lot of money. And there was the famous story about a woman called, I think I'm right, Viv Nicholson, who won over £1 million, and they interviewed her a couple of days later. You could always opt for no publicity so that if you won, you could keep it quiet because you don't want everybody knowing suddenly you've got pots of money. But she decided to embrace it and loved it and went out and really, basically her quote was, she was asked, what are you going to do with £1 million? And she says, I'm going to spend. And she blew the lot in something like 18 months, was then impoverished. But it was a good bit of fun. It got you a little bit of interest. It got you looking at form, but I couldn't be bothered with all that. I did the same numbers week in, week out. And I mean, 25 years, I never won a penny.
But they came round to the door, didn't they?
Yeah, they come round to the door and collect. They used to be collectors.
Knock on the door, what would that be, a Friday afternoon?
I think it was a Friday night, if I remember, because there were no games. Everything was 3 o'clock on a Saturday. Yeah.
This is back in the day when someone would knock on your door and someone would say, go and get it. Not, who the hell's that? They haven't texted us to let us know they're coming round.
Yeah, that's right. No people or anything. You'd open the door.
Great stuff. What about a match that's made you cry?
Oh, the last one was Amsterdam. Absolutely phenomenal. 50 plus years of watching football.
There?
Yeah, I was there. Absolutely incredible day.
With Martin and Cam?
I I'd met them through drinking Dam Square. I met other friends in Soho House. I did a little bit of culture by going to the Rijksmuseum, did a bit of tripping around on the trams.
Yeah, one wonderful place to go.
But I had to get to the stadium early because I was being interviewed for 5 Live and for ITV News.
Oh, great.
And the build-up and the anticipation that all of those Ajax fans had. We were there in hope, hoping that we could emulate what Liverpool did the day before, and never really thought it likely when we were 2-0 down at half time and the whole of the Ajax fans were singing, you know, Three Little Birds, Don't Worry About a Thing, which is the theme tune.
Yeah. I went to the first leg and I almost thought, well, we've done the Man City thing. That was brilliant. That's our highlight of the season. I almost thought we almost didn't bother with the first leg and certainly the first half of the second leg.
Yeah, well, the first 20 minutes, half hour of that first leg, they absolutely mullered us. And as we gradually got into the game and Ajax tired, there was a feeling that we could pull something back. And I know, again, subsequent interviews with some of the players and the management involved in that second leg, they felt exactly the same. They felt as if there was an opportunity that they could do something as Ajax blew up.
Somebody said that they'd done studies on Ajax and they are fantastic for an hour and then they blow up.
That's right. And that proved the point. Put them under a little bit of pressure at home. You know, two very quick goals from Lucas turned the tide of that game, although we could have still conceded late on.
Yes, yeah.
But to score that late with absolutely no chance that they were going to get back into the game was phenomenal, and being locked into the stadium for over an hour, well, probably less than an hour we were actually locked in, but we just didn't want to go with the players coming out and the management coming out, and it's the most intense feeling I've ever felt at a football match. And that's, you know, having seen the Man City replay when we won the FA Cup in 1981, having seen both UEFA Cup wins at White Hart Lane, that Ajax game, I don't think I'm ever going to go to a football match that will emulate that feeling that day.
And you say you cried?
Yep, I cried. I cried tears of joy. I'm not embarrassed by that at all. Wonderful. And I think part of it is probably the lockdown, but I was watching the highlights the other day when they replayed them, and I still cried then, and it still gets me. I still feel the emotion in my voice now talking about it.
Here's what I do. Right, so I flick between the BT Sport Unfiltered clip,
right,
which is the 10-minute clip of the whole game and the back and forth from the studio, and I love that one. And then I also watch the 10-minute game just off. And every time I watch it, I watch all the goals, but the Moura goal, the final Moura goal, I watch it, the hairs on the back of the neck, goosebumps. But the bottom lip goes every single time. I then rewind it, watch it again, rewind it, watch it. Probably watch it about 5 times. Then watch then watch the rest of it. Within those 5 clips, I call my son in, whatever he's doing. I say, just come and watch this goal again. So he has to come and watch it. Right, I've watched it. Yeah, off you go. Do whatever you're doing. And I just remember where, you know, I was standing in my kitchen watching it. You were obviously there. So you were up in that corner, were you, with all the fans?
That's right. Yeah.
When the goal went, let's just do it. Alderweireld kicks the ball out of play on 93 minutes, I think it is. He has a go at Ben Davies. Ben Davies then looks at him and goes, and this is all on telly. I mean, you might not be aware of this. Ben Davies then looks at Alderweireld and shrugs his shoulders. The commentator basically goes, oh, well, you know, they've given it a good effort. And it wasn't until 94 minutes and 40 seconds when, because on 94 minutes, their goalkeeper is getting booked for time waste. And it's not like we scored after the extra 5 minutes. We scored within that, right on the 95th minute. So you're up there, okay. Tell us what happened as the ball hit the back of the net.
I did a Victor Meldrew. I just go, I don't believe it. And then the tears of joy, I was hugging. I've subsequently known quite well the guy that I was hugging, you know. We've met on more than one occasion since. And it was just sheer elation, sheer joy.
So, jumping up and down, going mad, you were more of a hand on head, I can't believe it type reaction.
Yeah, yeah. Not bubbles, the lot. Yeah. Tears. I mean, the only regret I have at that day, it was two regrets actually. One, I had my phone charger confiscated on the way into the ground, and my phone died at half time, so I couldn't actually take a video of which I would have done of what was going on in yeah. with my emotions. And and the second one was, it's a very long story which I won't go into now, but I had a lucky coin which I took with me religiously to Sub Games, basically 1981 Cup final. 10 minutes to go, Hoddle gives the free kick. I'm rubbing the lucky coin. It goes in off Tommy Hutchison's shoulder. So it was a talisman for me for many, many years. And I started taking it again to games during last year's Champions League run. Yeah. And the number of times we got out of jail free, you know, for example, Barcelona, I had the coin. Man City, I had the coin.
Now, hang on.
And I had that coin with me in Amsterdam.
Hang on a minute. So what you're saying is, you went to Madrid, you left the coin at home, and it's your fault.
It is my fault. I got back from Amsterdam about lunchtime the following day, emptied my pockets out, couldn't find the coin,
no.
Lost it. So, yeah, it was all my fault we lost in Madrid.
There it is. There's no more need for any debate, Twitter, this back and forth.
Yeah, I mean, I had that coin for the best part of 40 years.
But what type of coin was it?
It was an American 1 cent piece.
Okay.
I found it in my change. I took it with me during that cup run in 1981. So it was a talisman.
Yeah.
There were things going on.
He's got that coin.
I think it dropped out of my pocket at passport control at Dover on the way back, but I no idea. Absolutely no idea.
My goodness. I told the story before about when I went to Madrid, and we got a program just before going in the stadium. And as I'm buying this program, the woman selling the program looked down on the counter and said, "Oh, don't forget this." And I said, "What?" And it was the ticket.
Right.
And I went, "Oh my goodness. Oh, thank goodness. Oh, thank you for that," because I breathe. So anyway, put my hand in my back pocket where I thought I'd had my ticket, and my ticket was there. So I looked at this ticket and I went, "No, that's not mine." And she went, "Oh, okay." So, but I had it in my hand. So I had two tickets in my hand. My dad was behind me. I said, "Dad, is this your ticket?" He went, "No, I've got my ticket here." So I had some poor fella had put his ticket down, bought a program and walked off. He would have had no idea.
Oh, how dreadful he must feel.
I feel
for people like Rob, you know. I'm sure, I don't know if he told the story when we were talking to him about the delays with Thomas Cook and the flights.
Well, he was on the same flight as that Terry Hill.
Yeah, of course, Terry was on it as well, yeah.
Yes, unbelievable. We've got a couple of questions to go. What about a funny moment you can think of, a whole match or a funniest moment you know in football?
One springs to mind. We played, I think it was Stoke. This would have been 80s sometime, and they had a fullback. I think his name was Smith, and he was the, shall we say, chunkiest footballer I'd ever seen.
Stocky, I think they say stocky, don't they?
Yeah. but we gave him dog's abuse when he was on our side of the pitch. So I was standing on the shelf, and we just gave him grief all night, you know, at all the pies and all that sort of stuff. And the more stick we gave him, the worse he got. I may be wrong. I've got a recollection that he was substituted, but that was one of the funniest things I'd ever seen. I feel for the poor bloke now, you know. But it was a bit harsh.
Okay. And what about your worst match you ever saw?
The one that, I mean, apart from Madrid and, you know, the heartbreak of that, you know, it was the semi-final against Portsmouth.
Yeah.
You know, I really thought we were going to win that game.
Yeah.
I made the schoolboy error of, that would have been March time, maybe April. It was a nice sunny day, so I went in just a Spurs shirt. I didn't wear anything underneath it. I didn't take a coat.
Yeah.
And I had to travel to Plymouth on business after the game because that was a Sunday. I had to be in Plymouth early Monday morning.
Yeah.
So my car was in the car park. And apart from, one, being really cold, two, it being such a miserable game with a miserable result, and then three, taking me probably as long to get onto the North Circular out of the car park from Wembley as it did get from there to Plymouth. And that drive of, I don't know, probably was about 5 hours. That is the most miserable I've ever been at a football match by a mile.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right with that one. What about, have you ever been scared at a football match?
Yeah, a couple of occasions. I remember I always used to stand on the park lane in the 70s. Mm. In the days when you used to be able to walk around the ground, and you know, it was the vogue was for the opposition hooligans to try and take your end. So I've been chased out of the park lane by Millwall and by West Ham. But I think the worst was that night in Rotterdam, 74 against Feyenoord. That's what I felt for my danger. I mean, the coach we were on, we got cleared out at half-time, so I think that was one of the very few games I've never seen the whole match for. We got cleared out at half-time, was on the coach got bricked and bottled, and we drove all the way back to, I can't even remember what port, Harwich, it wouldn't have been Harwich, somewhere on the Hook Island or somewhere like that, and we had a police escort out of Rotterdam, glass all over, you know, sort of almost laying there with coats over the top of our heads. That was really unpleasant.
Wow.
And I vowed from then that I would never, ever go and watch Tottenham abroad again.
Yeah.
And only, I think it would have been about, it had been the first game against Fiorentina, whenever that was.
Yeah.
The infamous Soldado miss, which was another miserable game.
Yes.
That was when I first eventually dip my toe back in the water to go abroad.
Hmm. Okay, mate, two more to go. Is there a player that you have loved over the years but you don't anymore? And if there isn't, that's fine.
Good question. Nothing springs to mind.
Okay, let's move on. There are two more now. what about a player that you've defended over the years? Everyone's like, oh, he's a load of old rubbish. You're like, no, I really like him. What a good player. Who springs to mind with that?
A bit ironic, having just mentioned about that game in Florence. Bobby Soldado, you know, I thought he was a good player. I thought he could have done something, but the team structure didn't really operate to his strengths.
I thought the first, let's say, 10 games, I thought he ran his backside off.
Yeah.
I can remember seeing him at the first game, Palace, where he scored the penalty to win the game.
Yep.
And then the subsequent about 10. And then I almost saw the moment that he lost all his confidence. I swear to you, I was sitting up watching him, and yes, he made about the 10th game in, and he made a run for the ball, and they didn't pass it to him, whoever it was. And he almost looked around, and he almost shrugged his shoulders and went, what am I doing?
Yeah.
What is the point of me making these? And it almost from that moment, I swear to you, I watched him from then on, and he didn't make those runs, and he almost thought, I'm done here. I almost saw the moment that happened.
Yeah, it's such a fine line, isn't it? You know, success and failure, you know, being fitting into the side and not fitting into the side. It's a shame because I think he's a nice guy, and I think he had all the talent in the world, but he just didn't suit the team that we had at that time.
Yeah, he almost maybe needed someone alongside him. You know, at the time, if you remember, it was Adebayor and him. And I saw the two of them play at West Ham in the last game of the season at the end of the Tim Sherwood season. And we'd lost against Chelsea, we'd lost against Arsenal, we'd lost against the bang, 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 bang. And we had nothing. It was an awful season. And I got a ticket to go to the final away game. And I thought, well, I'm going to go to West Ham, and I don't normally go away. And I thought, we're going to win here, and it will... I'll dine on it all summer. And we lost 2-0 to one of the most inept performances I've ever seen. And Bobby Soldado and Adebayor were up front. And then, thank goodness, a little chap called Harry Kane was sitting on the bench.
Yeah.
And, you know, the rest is history with that. But, Soldado, so okay.
Yeah. That's another one of those memorable games. You know, you're talking about Harry Kane and that away game at Villa, where they played Harry Kane and Ryan Mason as opposed to some of the older boys. It really turned around Poch. And he really then sort of put some faith in the youngsters. And suddenly, the progression from that day onwards was absolutely incredible to watch and be part of.
Yeah. Okay, final question.
Yep.
So aliens come down. They're around Stevenage area. They bump into you, and they say, the great Peter Haynes, the secretary for the finest football club supporter club thing. What is this football that people keep talking about? We have no idea. And you say, aha, watch this, and you hand them a DVD of a football match. What DVD? Are you handing them?
I think probably one of the... It wouldn't be a football match. I think I'd show them the celebrations for the finale of the last game at the Lane.
Yeah.
That with all of the ex-players going on, the emotion of the fans who were in the stadium... it touches upon the history, it touches upon how important that club and that stadium held so many memories for all of us who've been going there.
So starting from Kenneth Branagh introducing the history.
Yeah, absolutely incredible day, you know. Again, that was another one, you know. I remember being interviewed, and I said, you know, I got a couple of packs of tissues because I know this is going to be an emotional day, and it certainly was.
Did you invade the pitch?
No, my season ticket in the old stadium was in the West Upper, so
I probably walked past you several times because we were block two.
I was in block four. Yeah.
Ah, fantastic.
Yeah, many times. We've probably had passed each other and seen each other.
Yeah. Well, we used to, when I was with the boy, who was a lot younger, we used to watch the first, because always the second half was shooting at the other end. So we'd watch the first half, and then around 70 minutes, we'd get up and go and sit up the other end, to block eight. So we could see the Harry Kane score all his goals up the other end. Fantastic, brilliant. And your season ticket at the new stadium?
I sit just in front of Martin Cloak, and Kat.
Yeah.
It was a little group of us. We all arranged to have our seats together. Oh, really nice little group. You know, we try and get some singing going, and we try and rouse some of the people around us. Most of them are, you know, sort of regulars, which is good. You know, we don't get that many tourists just in, you know, two or three rows around us either, which is good.
I have no problem with the tourists, I have to tell you. I get quite offended when on Twitter I ask the other day I said, what do you mean by tourists? And they said, well, these bloody Koreans. And I'm like, oh, that is, I'm so offended by that. I can't tell you.
Yeah, there is, okay, they may support a player as opposed to the club, but I'm not bothered with that. You know, they'll come along and, you know, it's like back in the days. I can always remember back in the 70s, sometimes I used to sit at the top of the Paxton. And there always used to be a crowd of guys in sort of raincoats with fair hair and sort of thinking, well, they don't look like locals to me, you know. And it was the Scandinavian Supporters Club, always used to come. And even nowadays, I know there are guys that I've met from Norway who are season ticket holders and come on a regular basis.
Yes.
So I wouldn't knock anybody like that. I mean, the only thing I'd say is when, you know, for the year and a half we was at Wembley, I had a ticket in Club Wembley, and the seat next to me on my left-hand side, I think, was occupied twice. Mm. And it was someone who bought the season ticket, couldn't be asked to go to Wembley. And, you know, it really, my angle with tourists is that it just spoils that dynamic in the group that you're in and the people you sit around, in that it changes the way that people sing, the way that people shout. And it's why I'm pleased in a way that, you know, some of the pressure that we've put on as a trust to the club to say there are people who now need to move. Mm. And the club are now acknowledging that and obviously asking for interest from people who want to move their season ticket whenever that we'll be able to get back in their stadium, whenever that might be.
I am, and you're right in there, and obviously I do the podcast and I've got lovely seats at the stadium, have had since 91. You know, and I've got an ear to the ground. We've got connections within the club, and I'm so positive that they're gonna make the right decisions and go forward with this. But we have to stamp out this negative and quite wrong opinion that it's tourists that are ruining the atmosphere or whatever. First of all, we haven't had a decent result yet at the new stadium. The Man City first leg was terrific, but we haven't beaten Arsenal yet. We haven't beaten Chelsea yet. We haven't got that great, result that is going to stir the stadium and it's, you know, get the whole thing going. Unfortunately, we haven't had that yet, and I'm quite sure that as soon as we get that, we'll be leaving the stadium going, oh my goodness, my hearing hurts. You know, I can't hear a thing because the noise in that stadium. You know, when that happens, that kind of, and we have to just look at ourselves and go, listen, you know, you're sitting in that big bank up there, get something going. No one's stopping you. Let's stop blaming everybody else and get cracking.
Yeah. Oh, you're making me sort of, I want to get back in that stadium. Well, I know it's not going to be for a while, but
is there anything else you want to say about the current side, the current situation, anything else that springs to mind?
Not really. It's just from my angle as a fan, and also, you know, from the trust, you know, I want to get back into a stadium and I want to watch us play. I know that's going to be some while. You've also got a wife to consider. Who's shielding at the moment. My trips to London are very, very limited, and I can't see that changing probably until there's a vaccine around. But will I watch behind closed doors if it happens? Yeah, I probably will. For the games that I don't go to, when I'm watching football, I tend to have the sound down anyway, so I'm not that bothered about a lack of atmosphere. Mm. Will it be a different product? Yes, it will be a different product. I think there's some stats that I read the other day where they were saying there are fewer tackles. There are more decisions going for the away team than home team.
Yeah.
I don't know how
the games are longer because time wasting is there's no point to it.
Yeah. I read the other day, Steve Archibald's writing his biography at the moment, and he put a quote out from a chapter that he'd written, which basically said, you know, it wasn't talking about the current situation, but he was saying that if you don't have fans in a stadium inspiring you to give maybe more than 100%, I know that's a silly statement, but it does inspire you. The fans inspire you. The crowd inspire you. And without that, are you ever going to give of your best? I agree with Steve. I don't think as an ex-sportsman, I never played in front of big crowds or anything like that, but I knew that if people were watching me, he always inspired me to play a little better.
The only caveat to that is I think that Harry Kane couldn't give a monkey's. He just wants to get back on that pitch and score goals.
I think he does, yeah. I do remember a lot of them, you know, a lot of them, despite, you know, guys like, you know, Danny Rosen coming out and saying, you know, football
he
is...
He just wants to have his fish and chips up in Doncaster. Yeah,
exactly,
chips
yeah.
Wants to reopen.
But there are people who are genuine, you know, I just want to play football, you know. It's my reason for being. That's what I want to do.
All right, mate. Well, it's been fantastic chatting to you. And as I say to all the other guys that have been on, hopefully when we're back and at the new stadium, we can all meet up. I've suggested a podcaster's corner where myself, you, Theo, anyone that's sort of been, you know, on the do these podcasts, we can all sort of have a beer at 2 o'clock or something on a Saturday and sign autographs and all the rest of it. fantastic. Thanks ever so much, Pete. And
good to
I'll chat to you soon. And come on, you Spurs.
Come on, you Spurs.
Thanks, mate.